Good morning. You're listening to KPFK Los Angeles, 90.7 FM and 98.7 FM in Santa Barbara. More than public radio, we're community radio.
And nothing but the truth.
All rights reserved and affirmed.
Free all minds. These are weapons of mass descent.
These are weapons of mass descent.
Welcome to Uprising, a daily digest of independent news analysis, investigation, education, artistic expression, and activism. It's Wednesday, September 10th, 2008, and I'm your host, Sonali Kohatkar.
It just makes me stop and think.
Silence is not an option.
Heavy metal Islam, rock resistance, and the struggle for the soul of Islam, a special one-hour program, plus this week's Who Said That contest and the Subversive Historian.
My eyes drop when the fellow metal's out, but I can't help myself, why should I?
This is Uprising. Good morning and welcome to Uprising. In countries across the Middle East and South Asia, most of what we hear is the news of war, authoritarian regimes, gender discrimination, and religious fundamentalism. But struggling to be heard are the voices of a young generation of people singing, playing, and listening to hard rock, heavy metal, and hip-hop, infused with musical elements of their native cultures. It's a movement that has rarely been covered by the news, but it is alive and getting stronger. Influenced by classic American metal bands like Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden, thousands of young people in countries like Lebanon, Morocco, Saudi Arabia, Iran, and Pakistan are expressing themselves through music and often being repressed by their governments for crimes such as Satan worshipping. Now a new book by musician and history professor Mark Levine chronicles what he calls heavy metal Islam, rock resistance, and the struggle for the soul of Islam. Through interviews with musicians and fans, Levine introduces us to a world of young Muslims attempting to reconcile their religion with a passion for music and a desire for change. Today we'll spend the hour with Mark Levine and his colleague Reza Aslan about the topic of heavy metal Islam. The two of them joined me in studio earlier this week, and they're going to be part of an event happening tonight in Hollywood. We'll give you the details later this hour. And throughout this interview, you will hear the music of the heavy metal, rock, and hip-hop bands of the greater Middle East. Mark Levine is a musician who has recorded and toured with acclaimed performers, including Mick Jagger, Dr. John, Ozu Motley, and Hassan Hakmoun. He's also a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of California, Irvine, and holds a doctorate in Middle Eastern history and Islamic studies. Reza Aslan is the internationally acclaimed author of No God But God and his forthcoming book, How to Win a Cosmic War. He's also the founder and creative director of Boomgen Studios, a motion picture studio dedicated to creative content from and about the greater Middle East. Lay out for our listeners what forms of heavy metal or rock and roll you find in the Middle East and North Africa, and really what are some hot spots of that type of music in the region?
Well, the most interesting thing about metal in the Middle East is that it followed a very different trajectory than metal in the U.S., for example. One of the reasons I wasn't really into metal when I was growing up is that as I came of age, so did hair metal and glam metal, sort of L.A.-based, you know, not just Guns N' Roses, but Rat and all this kind of MTV-style metal that really didn't have any kind of social conscience or deeper message. And that kind of metal never really made it across the ocean to the Middle East and North Africa. What did was much harder metal, death metal, doom, gothic metal, all the ones that really reflect the roots of heavy metal, if you go back to Black Sabbath, in the kind of deindustrializing cities of the north of England that were really going through some of the first experiences of what we would later call neoliberal structural adjustment. So as one of the founders of the Moroccan scene said to me, we play heavy metal because our lives are heavy metal. You know, what are we supposed to play? Britney Spears? It doesn't fit when you're living in an authoritarian regime with very little hope for the future. So it's the harder metal that became popular over there. And as I discovered that, it really helped me understand in a new way what young people across the region were experiencing and going through, and how they could take a kind of music that to most people's ears seems really negative and even nihilistic and turn it into a life-affirming force that helps them confront these systems that have marginalized them socially and politically.
What are their main influences? Are they mostly Western bands like Iron Maiden?
Well, certainly I'd say the two biggest bands are Iron Maiden and Black Sabbath. Sit in the Middle East as I have and see an Iron Maiden concert like their first show in the Arab world in Dubai last year. And you see, you know, the album covers come to life in front of 20,000 Arab metalheads. It suddenly makes sense why Iron Maiden, with the images of death and blood and war for nothing, would make sense, because that's the history in so many ways that young people have experienced. But, you know, what makes metal in the Middle East more than just a copy of its Western variant is that so many of the best groups take local traditions and blend them in the same way that the best artists would do that, or the best writers or filmmakers. So you have bands that will take, you know, a riff that might sound like Sabbath or Iron Maiden, and they'll blend in, if they're in Morocco, Ganawa sound, or even a chant to a Sufi saint. Or if you're in Iran or Pakistan, they'll blend in local instruments and local cultures. And you create this hybrid that's really greater than the sum of the parts. And that, to me, really symbolized the positive aspect of globalization that so few people talk about, and how there really is a chance, as I'm sure Reza would agree, of building something positive in the future and not just fighting this war against each other.
Reza, how do governments in these various countries that Mark talks about in his book, Lebanon, Iran, Pakistan, how do governments respond to this movement, if you will, of young people?
Well, it depends on the government. You know, a country like Egypt, which is essentially a police state, tends to crack down a lot more harshly on these kinds of expressions of political opposition. And as Mark will tell you, as he writes about it in his book, Heavy Metal Islam, a lot of the Egyptian heavy metal bands and hard rock and hip-hop bands tend to shy away from overt political statements, certainly much more so than you see in countries like Morocco, where there is, well, it's still a police state, but there is still a little bit more openness and freedom for these bands. In other countries like, say, Iran, where almost every aspect of the creative culture has to be approved by the Iranian Ministry of Culture, the Iranian underground music scene tends to remain just that, underground, where I think in many ways it has far more power and much more influence on the youth culture there, because of the fact that it tends to divorce itself from the institutions of government. Now, in a country like Iran, I think it's important to understand that pretty much all of youth culture is underground culture. Iran has managed in an almost schizophrenic way to maintain a real division between the public realm and the private realm. And the public face that Iranians present is drastically different than the private face. And so you would expect music to have the same kind of sort of schizophrenic sense to it. I think that one of the things that's wonderful about this discussion of music in the region is that it reminds us once more, because I think we do need to be reminded of it, that this is a very diverse, really eclectic region. It's difficult because we use words like the Middle East as though this is kind of one monolithic region, and it's certainly not the case. What's wonderful about the music culture there is the way in which it has managed to bleed across borders and boundaries. And so, you know, an Iron Maiden fan in Dubai and an Iron Maiden fan in Egypt may not have a lot of other things in common with each other, but their sort of collective identity can be based around this shared sense of music and what that music means. And thanks to the internet and thanks to satellite TV and these sort of the new technologies of globalization, they have a way of communing with each other that would have been inconceivable even half a decade ago.
Mark, can you tell us about the ways in which governments have cracked down on metalheads, particularly these charges of Satanism?
Well, yeah, about a decade ago, in 1997, the first real, what they called a satanic metal affair, a satanic metal scare, happened in Egypt when over 100 kids, fans and musicians, were arrested, and they were charged or were going to be prosecuted for crimes related to Satan worshiping. And usually it involves also charges of being Zionists and helping to defeat Muslim culture. You know, really what this was a result of is the regime was in the middle of a conflict with violent Islamist groups, extremist groups, and they needed to show that they were defending religion to the average Egyptian. And the easiest prey, you know, is either homosexuals or metalheads, just because visually when you walk down the street and you see a metalhead, it's so obvious that they're different, that they stand out. Even to this very day when I walk through Cairo with friends who are metalheads, you can't imagine the stares they get. So it was an easy way for the government to crack down and show their quote-unquote Islamic bona fides. And this happened also in Lebanon. It happens regularly in Iran, but that's part of an ongoing process, as Reza explained. The most interesting one was in Morocco in 2003 when 14 musicians and fans were arrested. And in one of the only instances I can think of in my lifetime, these kids actually fought back. They staged protests. They did a concert in front of the courthouse. They got the international media using the internet to come and support these musicians. And it caused such a scandal for the government that they basically, after they were convicted, they overturned the charges and let them go. And then the metal scene kept getting bigger. So for me, the way these metal scenes are treated, and you could say hip-hop as well, but metal scenes are even more marginalized, is really a canary in the coal mine for tolerance both socially, politically, and religiously in these societies.
Book, you really get the impression that a lot of these underground movements in the various countries from Lebanon to Iran are desperately struggling for the freedom to express themselves through this music, and that it sort of goes maybe even beyond the music but becomes a lot about rebellious expression and speaking out against the government or even just larger for speaking out for social freedoms.
Well, I think that's absolutely true. See, what happened with the metal scene in the U.S. and Europe, perhaps because it was right at the end of the Vietnam era and so much of the kind of rebellious energy moved into punk, which also, again, was a result of the beginnings of deindustrialization and the loss of a working class. So punk, hip-hop, and metal all have the same social and economic roots. But in the Middle East, what happened is while in the West it became depoliticized very quickly and became all about, you know, drugs and girls and cheesy videos and spandex and weird hairdos, in the Middle East the initial political critical edge stayed. And it's a way of being critical of the government without having to use language that's so explicit that it could get you so easily thrown in jail. Because if you listen to a death metal song with brutal lyrics, unless you're in the scene, you're not even going to know what they're saying. And most of the kids who are in the scene are very wary about giving anyone the lyrics to their songs. And the hip-hoppers, you know, would say to me, look, if I don't want to get arrested, I'll just drop some Tupac Shakur in. And those who know him get it. And that means the government censors from, let's say, the Iranian Ministry of Culture probably won't get the illusions. So it's a way of creating an alternative community and culture right under the noses of these governments that they really don't know what to do with. And after a while, realize it's not worth the trouble to try to repress because it brings more bad press than, you know, than it would be worth.
I've been speaking with Mark Levine and Reza Aslan. Mark Levine's book is Heavy Metal Islam, Rock Resistance and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam, which we've been discussing this hour after today's Subversive Historian. And this week's Who Said That contest, we'll return to the rest of the interview. And by the way, Mark and Reza will be at an event tonight at the King King Club, 6553 Hollywood Boulevard in Los Angeles at 8 p.m. And they're going to be joined by the Iranian metal band Tarantist and by Tunisian musician MC Rye. And now for today's Subversive Historian.
This is Gabriel San Roman, your Subversive Historian. 111 years ago on this day in people's history, 19 immigrant miners were massacred in Latimer, Pennsylvania. On September 5, 1897, a county sheriff's deputized posse opened fire on hundreds of mostly Slavic, Polish, and Lithuanian anthracite miners. The peaceful demonstrators joined 10,000 others in a strike that began on Labor Day and called on the mining industry to improve pay and working conditions. Anti-immigrant sentiment was present among the sheriff's posse, as the mostly Catholic Central European workers often faced discrimination. Public outcry against the massacre prompted an investigation, but of course, no one was convicted. However, contrary to spreading fear, the Latimer massacre actually prompted 15,000 new people to join the ranks of the United Mine Workers of America. And the mine owners thought immigrants speaking different languages couldn't organize. I guess they and their guns were wrong. For Uprising, this is your truth professor saying it's no mystery why they conceal our history.
And now we come to the special feature of our program.
Who said that? Who said that?
Who is it?
You got to tell me who.
So what do you call yourself, huh? Como se llama?
I can't hear you.
What's your name, dude?
Who the hell are you?
I really want to know.
If it's anybody, it's me.
Who?
Who?
Before we go to part two of our interview about heavy metal Islam, we want to feature this week's edition of Who Said That, a weekly contest in collaboration with the Pacifica Radio Archives. Each week, we'll play you a short soundbite from the archives' vault and ask you to tell us who said that. All you have to do is call in and identify the voice, and we'll send you the CD from the Pacifica Radio Archives that featured the clip that we played. Let's take a listen to this week's mystery speaker.
The media establishment has managed somehow to pretend that feminism is about who's going to open the door for whom and whether or not women should wear bras. Well, of course, that's horse pucky. The real issues for women are violence and poverty.
Well, that's an easy one. So if you know who it is and haven't won yet, call us right now at 818-985-5735 with your best guess. That's 818-985-KPFK. We now return to the interview with Mark Levine and Reza Aslan about Mark's new book, Heavy Metal Islam, Rock Resistance and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Mark Levine is a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of California, Irvine. And by the way, he's about to release an album called Flowers in the Desert on EMI, featuring 24 artists that he discusses in his book, Heavy Metal Islam. Also joining us, Reza Aslan, the internationally acclaimed author of No God But God. is there a contradiction between the fact that a lot of these youth-led music movements in the various Arab and Muslim countries are influenced heavily by Western music, and yet, of course, one of the things that they're struggling are the consequences of U.S. foreign policy. Is there a contradiction in this sort of push and pull from the West?
Not really, because, you know, if you recognize this music as being an anti-establishment music, I mean, when you listen to Tupac or when you listen to Maiden, you know, these are people who are singing against precisely the same kinds of sentiments that, you know, most young people in the Middle East also, you know, have a problem with. So in many ways, it's sort of a way to reach out across the pond and feel as though the ideas, the aspirations, the sense of oppression that so many young people in the larger Arab and Muslim world feel, that the dissatisfaction that they have with their own institutions of government, that here is this music that allows them to communicate that feeling with Americans and with, you know, cultures that they may have very little in common with. So that's sort of the, you know, we always talk about music being an international language, and what's wonderful about the heavy metal scene and the hip hop scene in the Muslim world is how real that saying is. I mean, how you can just see it take place right in front of you.
I hear the sound of fear creeping slowly getting near. I feel it behind me. I see the end is near. I am tired, I am weak, sneaking inside me. Your blue eyes are the only sign life around me. Just like a stream and a bomb in this desert.
Then there are serious differences, because enjoying the music and certainly playing the music, in addition to the content of the music itself, is a political act, much more so in the Muslim world.
Oh, most definitely. You know, I think Mark said it just right, is that this is sort of it's become a secret language, if you will, a means for these kids to express certain emotions and ideas that would otherwise not be tolerated in their societies. And more importantly, I think it's a way of creating an identity between these kids that makes them feel as though that there is somebody who sort of understands them, that they do have a sense of solidarity in the situations that they find themselves in.
Mark Levine, what are some of the ways in which governments actually co-opt some of this music, if you will? I mean, we have satellite TV. How do these underground bands make it onto satellite TV? And if not, who does?
Well, this was exactly, I think, the pertinent question, because one of the things that was really frightening me is how good the government is at learning. And these governments have figured out, for the most part, let's say accepting Iran and Saudi Arabia, which, by the way, has a pretty vibrant metal scene also, you know, other than those two countries, the governments have started to realize, wait a second, we can arrest these kids and make new enemies and have, you know, more problems than we already need, you know, than we already have. Or we can co-opt them, and we can depoliticize them in the process. So what happens is that as these scenes start getting a little bit mainstream, and all of a sudden, if you're in the metal scene in Egypt, instead of having to have a concert in a, you know, dilapidated villa 30 miles outside of Cairo in the desert, you can have it right smack in the middle in, like, the Sawi Culture Wheel, which is a big rock club, or a club that does rock music, which is a very new phenomenon in Cairo. But of course, along with doing that is you have to get government permission. There's probably someone from the security services who's just there enjoying the show. You know, you can play festivals, maybe get a record deal, get some money. Then all of a sudden, maybe you're going to think twice about being too political. And that's happened across the board. And it's not just governments. It's also Arab corporations like Rotana, these giant entertainment conglomerates, all of which, as the price of getting fame, you know, and actually making money, which for most musicians in the Arab world is just an impossible dream, means you have to give up the original, you know, really potentially revolutionary content. So that's the struggle. And luckily, metal itself is still more on the underground in most countries. So kids haven't, or the musicians haven't had to make that decision, but in countries in the avant-garde like Morocco or Pakistan or other places that have very developed music scenes, or even Lebanon, where there's music businesses and video channels, et cetera, you have a little bit more of a problem of trying to maintain artistic integrity and still have a political edge, which most of these scenes started with.
Yeah, I think Mark's right. You know, that is definitely a real concern in the sense that, you know, these governments and these institutions are co-opting this underground scene and trying to contain and control the message. Certainly, that's pretty much what happened to the heavy metal particularly the hip-hop scene here in the United States as it became co-opted, you know, in the popular culture. And, you know, we went from NWA to Vanilla Ice, you know, within half a generation. At the same time, though, I think that what's interesting is that this is a kind of music that you may be able to co-opt it, but it's difficult to contain the emotion and the ideas behind it. And in some ways, it reminds me a lot of the way that a lot of these governments, say Egypt, tried to co-opt the Islamist agenda by, for instance, giving them platforms and allowing them to, have a much greater say in a way to think that, well, we can control the message ourselves if we begin to co-opt it. And of course, we've seen that that's impossible, that, you know, these are sentiments and ideas and expressions that are in and of themselves anti-institutional, anti-establishment, and no matter how hard the establishment tries to absorb it into the larger culture, it's really difficult to do, and it's a very slippery thing.
Role of religion in this music? I mean, you talked about government, and certainly there are many religious fundamentalist governments in the Muslim and Arab world, but is most heavy metal and hip-hop critical of religion, or is there an infusion or some sort of relationship?
Well, in fact, almost all the metalheads I know consider themselves good Muslims. And one of my friends in Egypt said, look, we love to go to the mosque for 3 hours for Juma prayers on Friday and then go play black metal for 4 hours in the evening. So they don't necessarily see a contradiction. And even the young woman who's on the cover of my book, who's a Kuwaiti American studying in Dubai and Sharjah, you know, she wears a hijab but also wears an Iron Maiden shirt underneath it. And while she's a bit conflicted, she's not conflicted enough about the two not to do that publicly. So they're able to have these multiple identities. But, you know, for me, I think when this all became clear was when I was in Iraq in, I think, 2004, and hearing and seeing Muqtada al-Sadr and realizing the way he's speaking, the way his language, his menacing, glowering look. He was Ice Cube. He was Ice Cube for young generation of Iraqi. You know, he was fulfilling that need and that role for young people. And if you meet, you know, as I did, you know, people from the Mahdi's army, they were young kids, the same kids who might be gangbangers in Compton, you know, coming out of the same very poor backgrounds, not educated, little hope for the future. So sociologically, there's a lot of similarities. But another Iraqi sheikh said to me when I was doing a conference with him, he said, look, I don't like metal, not because I think it's not allowed, but I just don't like it. But when we get together and we pray really fiercely and violently and are chanting and pumping our fists, we're doing metal too. And I heard this a lot as I traveled around the Muslim world, where you see a recognition from both metalheads and younger religious people who scholars or activists who might have been at least exposed to the music, that they both realize that extreme music and extreme religion are both dealing with the same emotions and catering to the same, you know, feelings. So they can either come together in a very violent way, and then you could get sort of jihadi metal, which doesn't exist, really, although there is jihadi rap, some pretty bad stuff, but that's there. Or it could come together in a more progressive way. And in fact, some of the biggest activists, let's say in Egypt, in the Kefaya movement or these other movements for change, actually came out of the metal scene 10 years ago. And the same thing in the Muslim world. I met many Muslim activists who, when they were younger, were metalheads, and they just took that anger and that activism, that need for catharsis and rebellion, and channeled it to religious and political activism. So, you know, there's a lot of cross-references, and I think that's why the best metal in the region is the ones that actually incorporates traditional, religiously inspired music into its sound, because then it's doubly strong.
My guests are Mark Levine, a musician and writer. He has recorded and toured with acclaimed performers, including Mick Jagger, Dr. John Ozo Motley, and Hassan Hakmoun. He's also a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of California, Irvine, holds a doctorate in Middle Eastern history and Islamic studies. We're discussing his new book, Heavy Metal, Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Also with us, Reza Aslan, the internationally acclaimed author of No God But God and the upcoming book, How to Win a Cosmic War. He's also founder and creative director of Boomgen Studios, a motion picture studio dedicated to creative content from and about the greater Middle East. I want to talk to both of you, and I'll start with Reza, about the gender dynamics within the music movements in the Middle East and North Africa. I mean, obviously there are even, you know, in any part of the world, you'll see sexism prevalent, you'll see you know, male domination in various ways, but how does it play out in the Muslim and Arab world, both from an underground level and also from sort of a government-inflicted, you know, desire to not see women in public spaces and playing music, Reza?
It's really strange because part of what makes this music, you know, an anti-establishment movement is precisely the way that it bends these gender identities that are so much a part of the cultures of the Middle East. And so there are, you know, really wonderful heavy metal all-girl bands in Morocco, Mystic Mood, these sort of, you know, like almost, you know, pussycat girls, you know, playing hard rock and heavy metal. And, you know, talent-wise, they're not great. But the point is that there is a level of excitement about having them up there in this public performance. Same in Iran. And my favorite hip-hop artist in Iran, Maryam, is a woman.
بذارم بگم بخ رو این نقوله بذار یه بارم بگم تقویه خالی کنم خودمو.
And so, you know, these gender identities that are so much a part of the accepted cultural norms are also part of what this music and this identity is rebelling against. And so it's much, much more relaxed, much more integrated than one would see almost in any other part of society.
Mark, what are your thoughts on the same? And how much of what we see in these musical movements is a result of government crackdowns?
Well, I think certainly Reza is absolutely right. You see much more gender mixing and women empowered in these scenes than you would in the rest of society. That doesn't mean they're as prevalent as they should be. One of the festivals I play at usually every year or two in Morocco, the Boulevard Festival, 2006, they actually had an ad in the back of their program saying girls wanted, because there just weren't enough girls. And people explained to me, if you have 20,000, you know, teenage Arab guys in Morocco together at a concert, it's not much better than if you have them, you know, at the Irvine Meadows or at the Spectrum or something. Girls are not necessarily going to feel that comfortable there, and certainly their parents aren't going to want to send them to a concert like that. So there's that issue of it's just a very male, metal is a male, and hip-hop are fairly male-dominated wherever you go. But the women are there behind the scenes, I mean, as producers of these festivals, and you see women in hijab who are there working as lead organizers of metal festivals, which, you know, shouldn't make sense, supposedly. Or you see, as Reza said, Miriam, whose stage name is Salome in Iran, is a perfect example. She's a fashion designer. You know, she's an incredible rapper. She raps with male rappers, which already is not so halal, we could say, in Iran today, that's for sure. And she also is fluent in Turkish, because she's Turkish as well as Iranian. So I met up with her once in Istanbul. And she's just breaking through so many different categories and is so empowering. And she's just the tip of the iceberg, because for everyone like her who I might know or we might know because she's a musician, there's many other women who are just doing this in their daily life, and there are many other men who are willing to encourage them. So it's the gender, I think, empowerment and equality is much closer in many ways, at least among an educated level, a certain level of education and class background, then is portrayed in the West, for sure.
چون از دست نمیره فرهنگ حتی در جنگ، پس نباید دوازه رنگ گردشمون به کلیپای تجاری جفنگ. ما جهان سومیم در حال پیشرفت، یک شرط داره اول شدن افتسالت و تر تحمیلات غرب که مال میشه مثل زمان جنگ سرد. باید در کرد تبادل فرهنگ، فرق داره با تهاجم فرهنگ، حق داره اگه کسی بگه در لنگ رپ فارسی.
And that's the music of Salome, one of the many artists that we've been discussing this hour with my guests Mark Levine and Reza Aslan about Mark's new book, Heavy Metal Islam. And in fact, Mark and Reza are going to be at the King King Club tonight at 6553 Hollywood Boulevard in LA at 8 p.m. For more information and to RSVP, you can call 310-657-5511. Now we are going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll give you the answer of Who Said That, our contest, and then we'll play part three of our interview with Mark and Reza. More to come. Stay tuned. And one of our machines is stuck as we're getting our brief message for the hour. So why don't we just go to the winner of this week's Who Said That, which is Glynis Golden Ortiz. Congratulations, Glynis, for guessing the correct answer to our contest. And the correct answer is Molly Ivins. A little bit of background. Molly Ivins was a populist feminist writer and columnist from Texas. She was perhaps best known for her humorous phrases and unapologetic hell-raising. Ivins authored a number of books, including Bushwhacked and Shrub. She passed away January 31st, 2007. We'll send a copy of the CD, Populism, Feminism, and the Old Boy Institution, to Glynis, our winner. It's an interview done with Molly Ivins by KPFK's Josie Cattogio and Dr. Betty Brooks, done on October 9th, 1991. And again, the winner is Glynis Golden Ortiz. She guessed correctly, Molly Ivins. Let's take another listen to the clip that we played of Molly Ivins.
The media establishment has managed somehow to pretend that feminism is about who's going to open the door for whom and whether or not women should wear bras. Well, of course, that's horse pucky. The real issues for women are violence and poverty.
Ah, we do miss Molly Ivins, especially in these times. For those of you who didn't win, you can order this excellent CD featuring this clip from the Pacifica Radio Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And we'll be back next week with another Who Said That. But stay tuned. After this short break, we'll return to part three of our interview.
Rock and roll music, and why I preach against it. I believe that it is a contributing factor to our juvenile delinquency of today. I know what it does to you, and I know the evil feeling that you feel when you sing it. I know the lost position that you get into in the peak. Well, if you talk to the average teenager of today and you ask them what it is about rock and roll music that they like, And the first thing they'll say is the beat, the beat, the beat.
Hi, I'm Bill Gardner, your host of Rhapsody in Black, classic rhythm and blues from the 40s, 50s, and 60s.
Join the fun. Get dogged around by Bill Gardner on Rhapsody in Black every Wednesday night at 10:30 p.m. right here on 90.7 FM, KPFK.
Welcome back to Uprising. We now return to the third and final part of my interview with Mark Levine and Reza Aslan about Mark's new book, Heavy Metal Islam, Rock Resistance and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. Mark Levine is a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of California, Irvine. Reza Aslan, the internationally acclaimed author of No God But God.
נעשה משהו אופטימי יותר. הרי כל יום אני מתעורר, רואה איזה אלף שוטר. אולי הם באו לעצור סוחר. הוא פה או לא, הם באו לרוס את הבית שלה.
What is the difference between the hip-hop movements and the metal head? Not only the character of these two, but also government acceptance of these two forms of music.
Boy, that's a really good question. And Mark would probably be able to answer it with a little bit more specificity. I will say that what I find to be really interesting is that in the same way that hip-hop has become in the Western world, essentially pop music. You know, when you're listening to a Justin Timberlake CD or you know a Britney Spears CD, and you know a quarter of it is essentially hip hop, then it's no longer you know the music that it originally was. So hip hop, I think, because of its prevalence on the radio in the West, has become a little bit more mainstream in the Muslim world than heavy metal, which still maintains very much its underground anti-establishment ethos.
You know, hip hop, you can find it in commercials. It's the sound of hip hop, the drums, the sampling, all that has become much more mainstream. Whereas you won't hear the kind of heavy guitars as much in many Middle Eastern or North African countries. So it's certainly still a bit more on the margins. Hip-hop, you know, there still are a lot of rappers who are trying to stay political, but they stay political by sticking to social issues without directly attacking the government and letting their listeners put the strings together, and they understand that it's a political critique. But most of them will tell me, you know, we focus on social issues, not political issues, because that's a limit we can't cross and still be allowed to do what we do. So you really have to have the right ear to listen to them, and that's how I think every subculture works. Those who are in the subculture get it, and then slowly it bleeds out to the larger culture. But, you know, because hip-hop's more mainstreamable, it also means it's easier to defang, you know, and emasculate its real revolutionary content. When you think of something, I mean, when I read first Fela Kuti, the great Afrobeat star, saying, music is the weapon of the future, you know, well, for every weapon, there's going to be a counterweapon. And the governments understand this, so they are adept at trying to figure out countermeasures to, you know, change a real bullet into first a rubber bullet and then into just a Nerf bullet, you know. And the musicians really have the struggle of trying to figure out how to keep those bullets, you know, as metaphorically real as possible so that they can keep the critical edge of their music, but still actually maybe make a living, maybe get a record out, maybe actually go on tour to Europe. Most of them have given up the idea of coming to America because whenever they do, they get so harassed just to get into the air past the airports that most of the people just say, forget America, let's stay in Europe. And that, of course, is a huge shame because then we can't really hear what young people are saying across the region.
There really isn't, at least in the minds of the audience for this music, a difference between the social and the political. I mean, they really do bleed into one, and I think that that's really the avenue that a lot of this music tries to focus on. When you talk about poverty, when you talk about the issues that are really in the minds of young people, you are making a political statement. And I would also say that that's very much true with regard to the issue of religion. We in the West think about religion as a private matter, as something that's sort of separate from culture and from identity. And that's really not true anywhere else in the world, but certainly not in the Middle East. And so it's not so much that these kids are or are not religious. It's that for them, religion and culture, religion and identity are one and the same.
Finally, let me pose this question to the both of you about the future, not only of these movements, but also in general how these movements reflect the larger issues of peace and war and peace in the Muslim and Arab worlds. Mark, do you see these youth movements through their music being a sort of an example, if you will, for how globalization can be positive and lead to a better future?
Absolutely. I think one of the best examples is the popularity among metalheads across the Middle East and North Africa of an Israeli metal band, Orphan Land, which is one of the founders of Oriental Death Metal. And this is, some of these Arab fans actually have their logos tattooed on their bodies, which is a double problem in many Muslim societies, tattoos and an Israeli band tattooed. And the fact that they all love this Israeli band, and this is not just any Israeli band, it's a band that has worked hard in their music and their messages to promote peace and against war and occupation. But it shows you how underground people have already done away with so many of these boundaries, whether they're national or religious or ethnic, that their leaders, whether they're religious leaders, economic leaders, or political leaders, have put up in order to keep power or enrich themselves.
Nora el Nora, Nora el Nora, Nezare di Gebura.
So to me, music, the reason music can be a weapon for the future is that it can get young people to stop buying into the official narrative, to investigate for themselves. After all, how do you find the music? You have to go on the internet. You have to search. You have to look around. Even in doing that, you start learning other things that you didn't even think you were looking for or wanted to know. So music really does have this revolutionary potential if we take, the money equation out of it, and if we trust the kids to do it themselves and not try to go in and save the day with them with, either invasions or Radio Sawa or all this kind of nonsense that's supposed to help them learn about us. They can discover us very well.
Radio Sawa is?
Radio Sawa. أجمل الأغاني وآخر الأخبار.
العالم الآن.
Radio Sawa is the U.S.-backed radio station, like Hora TV, same thing with television, that, supposedly is putting out, or is definitely putting out a quote-unquote pro-American point of view to help teach the young people, especially of the region, that we're not so bad, as if they need us to tell them what we're like. This is part of the arrogance and ignorance, I think, of American leaders and even of our broader culture, that we think we need to and can do this as if they can't think for themselves. The music shows that they can think for themselves quite well, and our job is to meet them halfway.
Mm. Reza, your thoughts on the same in terms of where you see this heading?
Think about it this way. If you're a teenager living in Tehran, what you know about the Jewish people is that they're all Israelis and that all Israelis are Zionists and that all Zionists hate the Palestinians and want to destroy the Arab world. That's essentially what you're taught, what you're told, every single, you know, avenue of information that you have gives you this information. And then one day you pop in, you know, the CD of Orphaned Land, and suddenly you realize, wait, these are Jews, these are Israelis, and they are complaining about the same things that I'm complaining about. And that they're not, you know, supportive of the government's policies in the occupied territories. Yeah. I mean, it's hard to explain this, I think, to a Western audience, but the sense of enlightenment that suddenly brings to someone is revolutionary. And so, you know, again, on the 10th, this event that Mark and I will be doing, you know, we'll have a heavy metal band there, Tarantist from Iran. Now, everything that you may know about Iran or about Iranian culture or about what Iran thinks of the United States comes essentially from the media and from these, you know, established channels of communication. But come and see, you know, a bunch of kids from Iran playing music with a message that, you know, might blow your mind. This is the power of globalization. It's the magic of music, and we're seeing it come together in ways that we really cannot understand yet, and we really cannot predict what the outcome of this is going to be, but it no doubt will be positive.
I've been speaking with Reza Aslan, the internationally acclaimed author of No God But God. His upcoming book, by the way, is How to Win a Cosmic War. He is also the founder and creative director of Boomgen Studios, which is a motion picture studio dedicated to creative content from and about the greater Middle East. And my other guest, Mark Levine, musician who has recorded and toured with acclaimed performers, including Mick Jagger, Dr. John Ozomatli, and Hassan Hakmoun, is a professor of Middle Eastern history at the University of California, Irvine, and holds a doctorate in Middle Eastern history and Islamic studies. And we've been discussing his book, Heavy Metal Islam, Rock, Resistance, and the Struggle for the Soul of Islam. The two of them are going to be at the King King Club in Hollywood, September 10th at 8 p.m. at 6553 Hollywood Boulevard in L.A. And for RSVP and more information, you can call 310-657-5511. That's 310-657-5511. And Mark, I hear you're actually going to be busting out your electric guitar on stage?
Yeah, certainly electric guitar and oud. And besides Tarantist, who, when I first discovered them, were literally in the basement of their apartment building in Tehran. That's the, you know, in a storage room. That's the only place they could play without being discovered by the morality police. There's also the great Tunisian rapper and Rai performer and rock and all-around great rock musician MC Rai. So it's going to be a really great night of music.
Great. Well, we'll put all the information on our website for our listeners to check out later today. Mark and Reza, thank you both so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
And again, that event is at the King King Club tonight, 6553 Hollywood Boulevard at 8 p.m. In this hour, we featured the music of Orphan Land, Dam, Arthemoth, The Chords, Sajid and Zeeshan, Tarantis, Junoon, Cafe Mira, Salome, H. Kane, and earlier on a little bit of Black Sabbath and Iron Maiden. Mark Levine will be shortly releasing an album called Flowers in the Desert on EMI, featuring 24 artists discussed in his book, Heavy Metal Islam, and a few we heard today. For more information about my guests and the book, visit heavymetalislam.com and rezaaslan.com. That's heavymetalislam.com and rezaaslan.com. For Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day, American composer Leonard Bernstein once said, "Music can name the unnameable and communicate the unknowable." That's Leonard Bernstein. That's Sonali Subversive Thought for the Day. You've been listening to Uprising. Gabriel San Roman is our assistant producer and Teddy Robinson is our engineer. You can hear an audio stream of today's show after 10 a.m. on our website, which is linked via kpfk.org. Our email address is mail@uprisingradio.org. CDs of the show are available at pacificaradioarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. I'm your host and producer, Sonali Kolhatkar. Thanks so much for listening.
In Los Angeles, the Baobab Project's first letter-writing circle of the year